To wrap up our show, Todd Sloan is going to be joined by his guest, Rebecca, to talk about the mental health effects of living under Trump. Todd?
Good morning. We're in the studio today with Rebecca Hyman, who is a therapist, anti-oppression activist, writer, scholar, and is working on a book right now about trauma, oppression, and social change. We're going to talk about the emotional and mental health effects of living under the Trump administration in hopes of making better sense of these effects and exploring our responses to them. First of all, we need to recognize that millions of people in the U.S. had already been experiencing ongoing oppression, threats, and insecurity, violence in the society, some from the government's actions or inaction. And we also note that many more privileged people have been profoundly upset, disturbed, etc., by the election of Trump and the first moves of his administration. These are perhaps the likely allies for people who are going to be directly affected by violence and oppression of the new policies and so forth. And from those people, I've heard a lot in town lately, people talking about how they can't focus, they can't sleep, they're irritable with their loved ones or just feeling rage in general, maybe drinking more than usual, maybe feeling depressed or numb, and their usual tasks that they do are feeling less meaningful. And to me, these sound like some of the things that people associate with the term trauma. And some of them even say, I'm traumatized by all this political stuff that's going on. So I'm curious, what can you share with us about all of this, these emotional, psychological responses to the Trump era from the perspective of a trauma specialist and activist?
Thank you so much for having me on the show and for asking this question. It's very dear to my heart. As you said, I just want to concur with the fact that that there's sort of two ongoing intersecting responses to this election and the ascendancy of this regime, one of which is a group of people who were less politically engaged and are finding themselves really shocked and overwhelmed and almost facing a sort of existential crisis in response to this. And then another group of folks who this election isn't a seismic change. It's if anything, it's a slight intensification or a ripping the blinders off of problems that have been that go back to the founding of our republic. So I'm going to try to speak to both of those histories.
Great.
Today. And, you know, it's interesting that list of I'll just at least initially call them symptoms that you're describing are things that are being written about in the media right now as sort of an emotional response to Trump or an emotional response to this existential discovery. And we're very used to thinking about emotional responses as something that happen at the level of the individual, that we are individually responsible for taking care of those problems. Mm-hmm. And that probably the best place to go if you're going to go anywhere besides to your, you know, family or friends is to go to a therapist and talk about your symptoms, and you might get a diagnosis.
Or get some medication for it.
You might get told you have anxiety or depression or PTSD. And for me, it's not that I'm opposed to any of those things. They can all be helpful. Obviously, I work as a therapist, so I believe that it's helpful and useful. But one thing that's been very helpful for me, both as a clinician and as an individual, is to draw actually on research that I've been doing for this larger book project now for a number of years, which is and going back to the social justice movements of the late 60s and early 70s that were rights-based generally, and the different strategies that both radical and reform approaches to activism at that time period took to violence and oppression. And one of the reasons that I find this very useful in thinking about trauma and emotions is that it takes us outside of this more medical model upon which therapy is sort of based, which, and the medical model tends to talk about an individual completely outside of its social context, what we call the universal body of medicine. So, you know, when you go to the doctor, for example, and that's, of course, the root of this model, and you tell a doctor that you have a cold, he's not going to ask you, if it's a male doctor, if you have a boy cold or a girl cold. He's going to tell you that you have a cold and, you know, give you some medicine for it. But when we're talking, from my point of view, about something like trauma or historical trauma or secondary trauma, to look at this sort of universal body we lose immediately access to the way we are all located in relation to multiple intersecting lenses and lines of oppression and social location, like class, gender, race, sexual orientation.
And all of those are relations as well.
They are relations as well. And so for me, one of the things that's really useful about the way social justice activists in the 60s started to look at these emotions, right, was to take them not as purely an expression of an individual, right? So I might feel sad. I might feel disempowered. But my sadness and disempowerment is inextricable from my social location. So I may feel disempowered because my party didn't win the election, right? But truly, I'm feeling disempowered because I'm internalizing my own oppression in a particular way. And I'm having my disempowerment, my structural disempowerment, my own disenfranchisement magnified and refracted.
And just processing it within yourself rather than seeing it as connected to all the external relations.
Right. And part of my feeling of disempowerment for me is connected to folks with other identities and other forms of oppression also being disempowered and also being disenfranchised. So it's an augmentation and intensification for me of my own feelings. So to say to me, well, you should go by yourself and figure out the root of your sadness, to me, that's not going to be as helpful to me to say, like, okay, my feelings of sadness, my feelings of disempowerment are inextricable from the freedom or liberation or oppression of those around me. And one thing that I found really exciting about the social justice movements in the 60s and 70s is that they really harnessed this small group model. The feminists called it consciousness raising groups, but the feminist movement took this structure from the New Left and from the civil rights movement. And the whole idea was that your individual feelings, your individual experience was there not so much to illuminate your own individual relationship to reality, but rather we got together in groups to use our individual experience to illuminate ideologies that produce violence.
And what do you mean by ideology in this sense?
So in this sense, I'm using ideology to mean less a system of beliefs and more a set of social structures that are taken to be natural. So for example, the ideology of white supremacy was taken to be natural until nonviolent social change erupted in the eyes of the white power structure and made white supremacy more visible. So ideology to me is something that we only come into relationship to the fact that it's not natural when we start to push against it.
Got it. It's what we call the critical notion of ideology.
Yes. Right. And if we think about it, the small group process was fundamental in different ways to the civil rights, anti-war, feminist, and gay rights movements. They all were based on these small group structures. And veterans coming back from Vietnam were also using the rap group structure. They called it rap group. The feminists called it civil rights. But the idea behind the personal is political was to illuminate white supremacy, militarism, racism, patriarchy, heteronormativity, and homophobia. Right? So we get together and we talk about our individual experience to illuminate these larger structures because they are creating the violence that is erupting. So in a way, this framework even diminishes Trump as an individual, right? Trump is a vector of these larger ideologies of violence. And so, whereas initially this may sound like a disempowering approach to recognize how many different ideologies are constraining us, at the same time, what was beautiful, I think, about some of these social justice movements was that they created activist projects that were a hinge between the personal and the political. Mm-hmm. So if we think, for example, about the Feminist Clothesline Project, which I'll explain briefly, and the AIDS Quilt, they're both forms of social justice activism that begin with an individual, but not to illuminate that individual, but to take the individual as representative of an ideological framework. So the Clothesline Project, for people who don't know about it, is a clothesline which was chosen as a symbol of women's work, and people would decorate t-shirts based on the violence that they had experienced, domestic violence, rape, childhood sexual abuse, and then those shirts were hung on a line so that you could witness the juncture between the individual experience of sexual violence and a mass image of just how prevalent this violence mm-hmm. is. And if you think about the AIDS quilt, again, right, the individual history of the person who died of AIDS, but if you think about the AIDS quilt being laid on the memorial, you know, the national monument, what that was like for people the first time they saw that.
Right. So there's, in all those cases, there's a linking of the what people are normally interpreting as personal and individual to the social and in a form of social action that addresses that issue as well, and empowers in the process.
Exactly. And the idea is of, again, understanding the root engine of violence to stop the violence. So we can, of course, it's necessary to talk about and to address trauma at the level of the individual. But if the individual who is themselves traumatized is also engaging in activism to stop the ultimate engine of violence, that can be a form of healing, a form of empowerment. And one thing that was really important to remember, which again, I think we can take inspiration from, is that small group process not only worked to help people understand and combat these systems of oppression, but they became a counterculture to the dominant culture. And so these small groups became a holding place where you could receive validation, justification, affirmation that what you were experiencing was indeed real, it was true, it was a form of violence, and that ideologies themselves are a form of violence.
Mm-hmm. So in this juncture these days, what do you see emerging that's sort of like the previous versions of these small groups? And I've seen lots of instances of meetup groups or indivisible groups and things like that. Are they sort of along the same line, or are they not quite the same? From what you can tell.
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I think it's very interesting that Resist meetup group is only a few weeks old and yet seems to have taken off, and the indivisible groups. There's certainly, I think, a desire for people to get together. I think one thing that's worth paying attention to is, especially in this moment, one thing that's happening that's really exciting is that folks are getting active for the first time. So they're likely to focus very much on the end result. And so one thing I think we can learn from these social justice movements is to pay attention to the hinge between the individual and the action. So yes, focus on the action. Focus on organizing protests and calling your congressman or doing direct action, but also paying attention to, can you be using these groups as a way of validating and understanding your own experience so that we don't fall into a belief that I hear a lot, which is I can't engage in social activism because I have to work on my own emotions. And rather to say that social activism can be a form of healing and addressing our emotional needs.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And there's certainly lots of opportunities that have been announced on the Old Mole Variety Hour in the show today. And every week there's a list of actions that people can take. I want to thank Rebecca for sharing her wisdom today. We've been talking with Rebecca Hyman, therapist, writer, anti-oppression activist, scholar. And this has been Todd Sloan for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here.